There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounce signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reeson, I'm your host. At the controls is Drew Tirico. And today we are lucky to have in the studio Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, which is heard each weekday here at 4 p.m. on WEFT on radio stations around the country, and author of the new book, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. So we'll be here to talk about the book and to talk about the media like we do many weeks, so do stay tuned.
Welcome to this earth. You made it the Charnel House.
Well, as we're scrambling for headphones here in the WEF studios, and I'm going to hand them over to you, Amy. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be with you. Great to be with everyone here at WEFT.
And you're on quite a whirlwind tour here. 65 cities.
70.
70.
Okay. I think it's 75 at last count.
Oh, okay. At last count. Wow. And you're having a good reception everywhere you go?
Oh, my God. The response has been overwhelming, and I really attribute this to the hunger for independent voices.
Mm-hmm.
On April 13th, we began in New York, where we hail from. We had a celebration of WBAI, Pacifica Radio, at the historic Cooper Union. The place was packed. It was all we could do to stop the police from shutting the place down.
Wow.
About 1,000 people. And then we flew out to Fresno the next day, KFCF. And place again, absolutely packed. As my brother and co-author of the book, The Exception to the Rulers, was speaking, I was out there trying to keep the police from shutting it down, talking to the students who couldn't get in. And then we moved on to Berkeley the next day. That day was the 55th anniversary of Pacifica Radio. And we were at KPFA, the first Pacifica station. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we're actually at the Prison Radio Project in San Francisco with Noel Hanrahan. And at 3 o'clock, exactly the same time 55 years ago, that Lou Hill went on the air and welcomed people to KPFA, that conscientious objector who came out of the detention camps and says there has to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. 55 years later, we got a phone call, 3 o'clock, and it was Mumia Abu-Jamal saying, on a move. And we had that interview for 15 minutes, being continually warned throughout. We were speaking to a prisoner. We could hang up if we wanted to. And then at the end, they cut it off. But for 15 minutes, we got to talk to him. And I can't think of a better way to honor independent media than providing a forum for the voices that don't usually get heard. From, in this case, from prison, 2 million people in this country in prison, largest prison population in the world, thousands on death row. And there was Mumia describing what life is like on death row. And then we moved on from the big event that night, celebrating KPFA with Michael Franti, who joined us, to the next night. The next weekend, we headed to the Santa Cruz area and at the Rio Theater, celebrating KUSP, another community radio station and Freak Radio, which is Pilot Radio. Yeah. And they've done a great job over the years. And then moved on to Santa Barbara to KCSB, which is a community and university station, which takes us into this week. And on Wednesday night, the big celebration of KPFK in Los Angeles. Over 2,000 people came out.
Wow.
The church, Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, was absolutely packed out. Tom Hayden was there, which was great to see him. We showed Independent Media in a Time of War, which we're going to do tonight, and I'm really looking forward to seeing WEFT listeners there. And then we went from San Francisco to St. Louis, where we were last night at an event at the Sheldon Theater, and this morning Union Democratic Communications. But, I mean, I think the hunger for other voices, the media being at an all-time low, the age of media consolidation, and yet these small, scrappy, ever so important stations still surviving. You put it all together, and it is an absolutely critical mix. And I am very excited to be on this. It's not just a book tour. The Exception to the Rulers media tour, celebrating media that is the exception to the rulers.
Well, we're very glad to have you here. And I guess the question that I've been wanting to ask you since listening to Democracy Now! For about 8 years going almost and reading your book is, how did you get into doing this kind of journalism?
Well, I think I've always done it one way or the other, whether in high school as the editor of my newspaper, the Maroon Echo, as my brother was, and then going on to college and reviving a defunct feminist newspaper called Seventh Sister. And then moving from there, I had written my college thesis on a contraceptive drug called Depo-Provera, which is injected into a woman's arm once every 3 months. It wasn't approved in the United States, but it was sent all over the world by then the Upjohn Company, which was based in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It caused cancer in beagles and monkeys. But women all over the world didn't know that. They weren't followed up on. They'd just be injected. And who knew what happened to them? But it was of grave concern to some. I couldn't afford to go all over the world to investigate this for my thesis, but I did go down to Atlanta, Georgia. And there we learned that the Grady Charity Hospital, the second largest charity hospital in Atlanta, had injected 10,000 black women with Depo-Provera. And so I did my thesis on science and society and the burden of proof, the case of Depo-Provera. It has since been approved in this country, which is not a very good thing. But I thought, why would I do this big thesis, spent months researching, for a couple of white, upper-class male professors? I don't know how it would help them. And so when I left college, I turned it into a series of articles and whole issue, along with my colleague, Christina von Henneberg, an issue of the Multinational Monitor. And it was called The Case Against Depo-Provera, and we really explored it in all of its aspects. And as I was doing that, this is a very long roundabout answer to say that I had gone home to turn it into these articles. And I turned on the radio as I was working, and I heard this incredible radio station called WBAI. I knew nothing about it. It was just all of the beauty, the glory, the ugliness, the horror of New York City. The full diversity of languages and accents, the debates, the disgust, the beauty. I thought, what is this station? They weren't selling anything. They weren't stopping for commercials. Extremely authentic and raw. And I just listened. I was transfixed. I went to a local community college to take a class in biochemistry. I've always been very interested in science and nutrition. And I was taking that graduate class, and I saw they were teaching a course in radio documentary. I thought, oh, that's mm-hmm. like what I listen to. So I went over. The professor was a producer at WBAI. He was starting a show the next week called Investigations. Well, he was Australian, so he had that speech impediment. And I went up to him after the show and said, I would like to help. And he said I could be his apprentice, not in the Trump sense. And so we went over that night to WBAI. It was January of 1995, and I never left. It's 19 years later. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to find at the beginning of my career what people search for their whole lives, and that's independence. And it's been absolutely an amazing journey.
And so WBAI really gave you the support and the space to do this sort of journalism that really is very unique. And I think even in some ways very unique for the time, because it was the Reagan era and not a time really supportive, I think, in many ways.
Well, 1985, right? I said 95. Thank you.
I was doing the math in my head.
Thank you very much.
So, and the reason I ask is because, I mean, part of the reason I do this program is to both celebrate independent media and to demonstrate that all these things can be done by all of us. And to sort of show that there are places, if it's some place where you're looking to go. And so how did it come that you started to do Democracy Now?
Well, I started doing the news after a year, which taught me the discipline of keeping things short. But I always made it very heavy on the cuts. I don't see the building of a piece as, you know, sort of script and then cut and then script, sort of building bricks on top of each other. I more see it as weaving the script into the cut, out of the script into the cut, but very heavy on the cuts. If I could not write any script at all, I would be very happy. Let people speak for themselves. And then I went from that and being the news director to being asked to do the morning show with a man named Bernard White. And we started that in 1992. I didn't know Bernard at all. I knew he would come up from Virginia, and I would see him lumbering down the hall carrying, it must have been 100 pounds of LPs, every Martin Luther King's birthday. And he would do a special all day, bringing us not the speeches we knew, but the rare speeches and discussions of King. But I didn't know him. And I guess the first time we really talked, no, it wasn't in our meetings before doing Wake Up Call, the morning show. It was that morning that we started Wake Up Call together. I guess we sort of met on the air. And we did it for 10 years with many magic moments, incredible times together, providing a forum for people to speak for themselves. I think of Maurice Bickham, a man who was put on death row at Angola Prison, Angola in Louisiana, named for the country in Africa where the slaves were brought to work this plantation that became a prison. It's the largest now plantation prison in the country. And you can have pictures of black prisoners holding shovels, walking, hundreds of them with white guards on horseback, riding next to them. And Dave Isay, who's a great producer for NPR, who got his start at WBAI, called me up one day and said, you got to do the story on Maurice Bickham. He had met him when he's doing a piece called Tossing Away the Keys about the lifers at Angola, who were starting to commit suicide. They'd been there for, say, 20, 30, 40 years, and they just start running one day when they were outside, knowing they'd get shot in the back. But they were just giving up. And Dave had done a piece and said, no, but you got to do something on this one guy, Maurice Bickham. He shouldn't be there. He's very sick. He was convicted of killing two sheriff's deputies. They had come to his home in the middle of the night wearing their pajamas, Klansmen, and they attempted to kill him, and he shot back. They tried him one day into a night, and of course it was an all-white jury, and he was thrown on death row, and then death row was overturned, and then when it was reinstated, he was put back on it. And he lived for almost 40 years in prison, didn't know integrated society. And he said he's going to die there, and he doesn't want to. And so we took up the case. I mean, I said, Dave, well, why don't you just do more of this on NPR? It's so much bigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. You're going to reach millions and millions of people. This is WBAI. First of all, it's local. No, no, no. He said, you're the ones who will be able to do it. I don't care how many times, he said, I do this on NPR. Only BAI could free him. And so we took it on, wake-up call. And we started by having Maurice on the phone. And we got him on the phone with his daughter and his granddaughter and his great-granddaughter. They'd never all been on the phone together. In fact, I think he was talking to his great-granddaughter for the first time. And he kept getting cut off every 10 minutes, same way Mumia, you know, it said you're speaking to a prisoner, click, right when everyone would be crying and everyone talking to each other. And then we put him back on, get knocked off, put him back on, get... I mean, at the end of this conversation, people were calling us from everywhere. I remember a woman who worked at Kennedy Airport called me weeping. We'd given out the governor's office number. And I think they got a lot of calls because they changed their number. But we found it out and we gave out the new number. And it just didn't stop. Then Maurice's lawyer called and said, this is not going to help. I've talked to people inside. They are not going to free him. And this is only going to make things worse. Well... within a year, Maurice Bickham was pardoned. His sentence was commuted, and he was getting out. And when the New York Times interviewed them, they said, I think it was Nightline that interviewed them. I don't know if this got on the air or not. I think it might have. Probably not. Probably got on the editing room floor. They said, there's this station in New York called WBIA, and they just never stopped. Uh-huh. And... they said it drove them crazy there. People, we didn't have to even keep on giving out the number. Okay, maybe we did. Maybe we did do it, but we didn't have to because people remembered the number. And it was sort of like part of their day. They got up, made their coffee, got their kids ready for school, made their call to the governor's office, and then went off to work every day. And this went on for months. We then got the call. Dave was waiting outside the gate at Angola in a van, waiting to take. Pick up Maurice as he crossed over into the free world. And they took him to his mom's grave. She had died while he was in prison. And then they took him to a telephone booth and he called us. And you know Nina Simone's song, I wish I know how it feels to be free. I don't sing too well, but it's in my head. I can tell you it's perfect pitch in my head. He said he wanted to come up and spin some discs with us, and he said he really wanted to hear that song. Well, that was Maurice, and he moved to Berkeley or Oregon or Washington. And then we got a call on Martin Luther King's birthday. The night before it was Dave Isay, and he said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, this is Bernard's big day every day for 20 years. You know, he had the whole show planned, and we just went along for the ride. And he said, you have any room for a special guest? I said, well, probably not, actually, because we're really, it's very carefully planned. And he said, well, because Maurice is coming to town. I mean, we'd get to finally meet Maurice Bickham. Brian Gumbel was bringing him in for when he was on CBS Morning Show, be on for 5 minutes maybe, and him and his daughter. And then they'd come over to BAI. We started to say it that morning at 6, we'd have a special guest. It was Maurice Bickham. And people started coming from New Jersey and Connecticut and Pennsylvania and New York, everywhere, bringing their kids and their grandchildren to bring him gifts. And then Maurice walked in with his daughter. And he sat down, put on that record, I wish I could know how it feels to be free. And Maurice put up his hands, and his daughter stood behind him and held his hands up. He just closed his eyes and cried as he sang the song, and everyone in the room cried. Maurice Bickham was finally home, a place he had never been, but this was home.
Wow. Quite a victory for independent media, then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why do you think NPR couldn't have accomplished something like that? Exactly.
Because what matters is not the occasional story. I mean, that's interesting, and people hear it. But it's the drumbeat coverage. That's what affects people. And it works the other way, too, and that's the problem. That's why the media has reached an all-time low in this country. The way it works the other way is just look at the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The drumbeat coverage for war. They know how to do exactly what we did with Maurice, but the other way. It wasn't to free someone, though the administration said it was. Mm-hmm. I just get so confused right now when the reason the administration gave, well, the primary one, was weapons of mass destruction and to liberate the people of Iraq, to free them. And yet what do we see now? In Fallujah, fierce fighting. In Basra, 20 kids just killed in a school bus, 68 people dead altogether. In Baghdad, of course, the killing continues. More than 10,000 Iraqi civilians dead. We don't even know the number. This is to free them, to save them? The media knows well how to do nonstop coverage mm-hmm. on something. It's almost like carpet bombing you with lies. And that's where the media really disgraced itself. The administration lied. We know that. But it's, you know, it's not just the Bush administration. You expect governments to lie. We don't expect that of the media. We are supposed to dissect the lies. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one that is enshrined and protected by the Constitution, because it is the check and balance on government. It is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. And instead, the media simply acted as a conveyor belt for the lies.
Which you've documented, I mean, pretty well here in your book, The Exception to the Rulers. Why did you decide to write a book? I mean, you do radio every day. You manage to speak to people across the nation. Why turn to books? Because in many cases, I mean, sales of books don't even add up to the daily listenership of the Rush Limbaugh show.
Oh, well, I think we have to look at the whole media landscape. Democracy Now, a few years ago, was broadcasting on a couple dozen community radio stations, and that was great. Now we're broadcasting on more than 220 Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, community stations like WEF, NPR stations increasingly, people wanting a different set of voices to complement that programming. We're also broadcasting on more than 100 public access TV stations now, PBS. We're broadcasting on Free Speech TV, which is Dish Network's channel 9415, four times a day. We're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. We're broadcasting on radio stations across Canada and across Australia and in Europe. It is astounding. The largest public media collaboration in the country. Why a book? Because people get their information every different way. Some don't listen to radio. Some don't watch TV. And books is how they learn about the world outside of knowing people and learning directly. And so we decided to write this book to reach out even beyond the audiences and the people that access are able to get Democracy Now.
And you're... publisher is Hyperion, and I mean, it's just like, you know, the electronic media, also the print media now is part of the same complex of companies. My question is, so how welcoming did you find the publisher to do a book such as yours, which is so critical of the mainstream media, and indeed, you know, of ABC, which is co-owned by Disney, which also owns Hyperion?
That's right. Well, I guess the same... Well, they hardly touched the book, I have to mm-hmm. say. It was quite astounding in the whole editing process. You know, occasionally, I mean, I learned things like when you use a colon and when you use a semicolon, I didn't know. I thought a semicolon came when there was a sort of sentence afterwards. A colon was a list of things, but that's not true, actually. You use a colon often even when there is a kind of sentence afterwards. That's the kind of thing I learned. But as for political content, it wasn't touched. And why do it there? Perhaps the same reason why I went on Fox this morning in St. Louis, the local Fox affiliate. Now, I don't know how many times people there heard a critique of their own network. But look at today. You have the story from memoryhole.org where this webmeister got a hold of hundreds of pictures of soldiers' caskets from under the Freedom of Information Act, and now they're everywhere, breaking the barrier and the executive order of President Bush because he knew the power of those pictures. Every network ran it but Fox. And I thought it was important to talk about that on Fox, to talk about the fact that it's so important to see these images. And the Fox anchor said to me, "What are you talking about? If we saw images of, you know, the real casualties of war during World War II, people wouldn't have fought it. Do you think that would have been a good thing?" And I said, "I think it's important to know what we're doing. And if we're engaged in war, we should see what it looks like and feels like. We should see the effects of it." I don't know how often they get that on local Fox affiliate, but I know there are a lot of people watching, and we have a responsibility to cross borders, if you will. And this publisher was a kind of bridge to that, to reach out to communities that I might not have access to. And more, it's a kind of mass publisher. And, I mean, radio is amazing because it's mass media. And when I was covering the Zapatista uprising and went to the first news conference that Subcomandante Marcos and the Zapatistas had in San Cristobal de las Casas, they had it only for radio reporters because they said that was the most important mass medium that people could access no matter how poor they were. There was always a radio, if not in a house, in a community. And I think mass media is important. I'm not sure where this will take us, but I thought it was important to start the journey and to bridge people from community world and the commercial media world, because I think we don't have as much division between us as we think. I think that political labels are breaking down, and I think the media should serve as a bridge. But I don't think that the exception to rulers should just be our motto at Democracy Now! Or a description of WEFT and all the amazing community stations tonight, very excited to celebrate and have a fundraiser for WEFT here. I think it should be the motto of all media. That's my goal.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. And you will be in 15 minutes over at the Illinois Disciples Foundation, corner Springfield and Wright, to show first this half-hour video.
It's an amazing video, Independent Media in a Time of War. I really encourage people to come. Thousands of images of the corporate media's coverage of war, and it laid on a speech that I gave about a year ago as the bombs were falling, just an excerpt of the speech. But the Hudson Mohawk Indie Media Center that put this together did an amazing job.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of it today, getting everything prepared in it. Yeah, it's very nicely done. And then you will speak for a bit and be available to sign books.
That's right. And I really look forward to seeing WEF listeners. I really look forward to meeting you. This is my chance to be here, to say thank you to WEF, say thank you to Mick and Paul and everyone here. It really matters, community radio. It brings people together. It's both very local and oh so global, because local issues are global issues. And what we do in our home communities has reverberations around the world, and I'm going to talk about that. And I do hope everyone comes out. I really would love to meet you personally, and also to send a message to the publishing world. There's this proliferation of conservative imprints in the publishing industry. You know all about the Laura Schlesingers and the O'Reillys and the Hannitys. They're all writing books. And the publishing world says we need an imprint for this one and for that one and for this one. But I deeply believe there's a hunger for alternative voices as it demonstrated in each place that we go. And we want to prove that to the publishing industry. And every book that succeeds in our world to cross over, every book that succeeds, makes a space for another book. The publishers go out and start to scour and say, hey, maybe there is, well, they call it a market. I call it a community that crosses borders. So I really look forward to seeing folks at Illinois Disciples Foundation, 610 East Springfield Avenue tonight. starts at 6:15. People will gather. I am so excited to do this, and a big shout out to everyone who supported WEFT. And even if you've just listened and you've never paid your pledge, well, keep thinking about it. I believe that that listener will soon become a listener sponsor. And thank you for being here and doing this, Paul.
Well, thank you, Amy. And
that brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.